Hi, and welcome to Forest of the Future, the podcast series where we talk about innovations and trends and grand ideas in the world of sustainable forestry, climate mitigation, and of course, FSC. Today we're going to get nerdy about a legislation which has actually been around for a while, but which we haven't covered yet. And we're going to dive into it because it is a complicated matter, but it's also a very important matter. It is the legislation in the EU which couples sustainable transition with financial incentives. The legislation is called the EU taxonomy. It is the economic vehicle of a larger EU package called the EU New Green Deal. Under this package, you will find other well-known legislations such as the EUDR, the EU Waste Directive, the CSRD, the CSDDD, or the EU Green Claims. To make me a lot wiser on this legislation, how it works, how it fits in the world of FSC, and where we are in the status of implementation, I've asked Asker Olesen to join me. He is the Global Head of Climate, Biodiversity and ESG at International Woodland Company. If you think the name sounds familiar, it's because he is a former colleague of ours. And I've also asked Andre Terribus to join me. He is the Senior Advisor for Verified Impact at FSC International. And just a caveat, if you don't know anything about the EU taxonomy, don't worry. Neither did I before this conversation, as our interview will surely reveal. So with that, why don't we just dive right in? Hi, Asker, and welcome to this first episode where you're now working for International Woodland Company instead of FSC. Can we perhaps just try to start with you telling us a few words about your new role? Because I'm quite sure that it connects very well to the topic of today.
Thanks, Laura. Great to be back and good to see you again. I'm back into the forest with International Woodland Company. One could say living the dream or practicing what has been preached before. So it's very much within temperate commercial forests around the world, FSC certified forest, where I'm leading the efforts to not only, as we should talk about today, integrate EU taxonomy and SFDR, but also building resilience, improving biodiversity, and building up carbon stock in these forests that supply all of us, supply IKEA, supply pulp, supply the products we use every day.
Okay, you just mentioned an abbreviation in there that I don't know. SFDR. What is that?
Legal text on top of the EU taxonomy. So that's the Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation, which is the financial sector's equivalent to CSRD. So it basically does the same. It just follows, let's say, money instead of following products. And that makes a lot of sense because on one hand, it's the products that flow through the economy and end up in as consumer goods for you and I. But in all of that process, there's been a lot of investors, there's been lending, there's been mortgages, there's been credits, and all of that. And all these flows of finance also need to streamline, also need to align and support climate change. You can't only do that from the end user's point of view.
Okay, so let's maybe use that as a stepping stone, because you said that that sits on top of the EU taxonomy. Can you just tell us then, what is the EU taxonomy?
EU taxonomy is, to some extent, what we've always needed. It's a taxonomy. And what does that mean? That means it sets out the vocabulary that we should use when we talk about sustainability. And it also sets out some what's called do no significant harm criteria, DNSH, which is a lot of no-goes. A lot of things you shouldn't be doing in a given sector if you want to call yourself green or appraise your product or appraise your business for sustainability credentials in general. But that's a taxonomy. You don't make a taxonomy more. It's not as if anyone would force anyone else to use a specific wording in their everyday lives. But the EU taxonomy supports SFDR, the CSRD, the Green Claims Directive, and a number of other directives where there is reference to what is sustainable. So these, let's say, sector-specific policies or use case-specific policies that I just mentioned, they all rely on the vocabulary of the EU taxonomy. So they set out in law, if you want to appraise yourself, if you want to highlight for the good you've done, with your product, with your business model, whatever, then you have to disclose. So tell me how good I did and in what way I did good. And then you can choose at this time, you can still choose to use the EU taxonomy to make sure that the disclosure you make is comparable, is transparent, that you can go back as an outsider and look up, okay, if they do that using the EU taxonomy as a vocabulary, then you know what that means. So it creates a common language for what sustainability is. And honestly, we've been short of that for the last 15, 20 years. SFDR, EU taxonomy, CSRD, green claims, and a number of the other regulations, also the upcoming EU regulation on carbon removal certification, also refers to the EU taxonomy. It's sort of building a system within which we can scrutinize if a company, in a transparent and comparable way, if a company has done good. Setting that in law is a major achievement.
Okay, I'm just checking to see if I get it right, because it feels like all of the bits of the puzzle are falling into places in my head. So the taxonomy is sort of the backbone that sits behind all of them. And then you have the sustainable finance disclosure regulation that follows the money, like you said. You would have the CSRD, which requires that you report on your products and what is in your product, that you assess what is the impact of your products on a double materiality.
Yeah, of your company.
And of your company. And then you have the green claims, which regulate how are you then promoting those products? How are you marketing them? And do you have proof that your products actually have the impact on the globe that you claim that they have?
Exactly.
So what is inside that taxonomy? Does this taxonomy in itself regulate anything, or is it just what you say, a set of definitions?
It's a little more than definitions. Taxonomy has grown to become a huge complex of delegated acts and guidelines and interpretations by various groups and so on and so forth. And why is that? That's basically because we're trying to, let's say, install a new language for the entire economy. That's no small feat. Mm-hmm. The EU taxonomy consists of a long range of economic activities. And there is one for forest management, there is one for forest conservation, there's one for afforestation. And for each of these, negotiators in inclusive consensus processes with all of the implications of that identified what's called TSC, technical screening criteria. And that's the ones you need to look for. So if you go in there, let's say as a forest manager, so you look for the forest management economic activity, then you look at the technical screening criteria for that activity. And when you follow these, then you are in your practice of managing your forest, then you can claim to be EU taxonomy aligned in the way that you communicate your sustainability credentials. And obviously, I think last time I checked, there was some 50 or 60 economic activities. So if you look at that, in its totality, it's completely incomprehensive. But very few companies would need to look at all of it. And obviously, from an outside, that looks like a bureaucratic monster. But you have to keep in mind that it trickles down. There is a pretty good EU taxonomy navigator tool by the Commission where you can look up, you can find in a digital interface, you can track what applies to the economic activities that are relevant for you. Then you find those technical screening criteria. Then within those technical screening criteria, some of them are what we call do no significant harm, DNSH. So that's the things you cannot do. And then there are substantial contribution. That's additional criteria. If you say, I want to go above and beyond do no significant harm in my activity, then I align with the criteria, the technical screening criteria that refers to a substantial contribution. And then if you do that, then you have your, let's say, reporting and disclosure package ready, describing how you do. And then you can use that to meet your disclosure requirements under SFDR, CSRD, green claims, and other legislation. But you can also, and that's important, you can also meet your disclosure requirements for the time being, at least, under any of these regulations without using the EU taxonomy. But then obviously, maybe doing a disservice to your end users or your stakeholders or shareholders, because then it's much more open for interpretation. What do you mean by sustainability? So if you want to be clear If you want to be consistent, then you use the taxonomy.
And how is it connected, if we look at it from the financial perspective, because I think that's where the direction I'd love to pivot the conversation in. What is the incentive there, the financial incentive there for? So one thing is the reporting that you have in CSRD, which is just a mandatory reporting. But what is the incentive when you go over towards the sustainable finance?
The thing I like a lot about some of this new EU legislation in this space is that it is, let's say, opt-in. It's a conditional mm-hmm. opt-in legislation. So it always starts from the basic question, do you want to appraise yourself for sustainability? If you do not want that, then you don't have to follow any of this. But if you want to say anything around how sustainable you are, then you have to follow it. If you opt-in for a number of big financial institutions, it already applies right now that the SFDR is, let's say, mandatory. If you want to appraise yourself, again, then you have to do it. And that will roll out to more and more companies, smaller sizes, over the next couple of years. If they do so, then that's because they need to show to their clients, their shareholders, that they are green. Maybe some of them don't really have that pressure, in which case they don't do it. But what we've seen over the last 10, 15 years, which you've probably also, and we've all been part of that, is that particularly for pension schemes, pension money is a huge bucket of money in Europe and also in the US. Pension holders have been voting through over the years that the pension schemes must invest, shall invest sustainably, and they shall set net zero targets. And a lot of them already have soft biodiversity targets. So they've had that commitment from the General Assembly. They have, whenever they then go do an investment, they have to find a framework within which there is high credibility, where they can report and disclose and show that they've met what their pension holders has voted through, the General Assembly has mandated them to do. And that's where the demand for the SFDR comes in the other way around. So we have this nice, let's say, duet between us, you and me, placing money in various financial institutions, and the EU legislation saying, if you want to promote yourself and your green credentials, then you have to do it this way around. That top-down and bottom-up pressure meets and creates the need for SFDR disclosures. Don't underestimate in Western economies how much power the pension schemes have. And that also goes for insurance. We've voted mm-hmm. that through to a large extent for insurance schemes, and they are backed by reinsurance schemes. There's a movement.
Mm-hmm. I have two follow-up questions. The first one is, you've now mentioned insurance schemes, you've mentioned pension funds. Are these the only two big buckets of money that are being driven by the EU taxonomy, or do we have others, or are others coming up? What about governments and their investments? What about large corporations, global corporations and their investments and such? Are they moving as well?
If large corporations, and that's typical in Central Europe, they often have their own employees' pension schemes in-house. They may also invest on the book, invest from their own money. And again, if they do so, and if they want to make claims on themselves being a green company, then they have to follow that. It's wide. It applies beyond pension and insurance schemes. You also see a number of banks in Europe that say, okay, it improves our value proposition towards bank users that we can document and disclose. We only invest sustainably. There's also a lot of wealth offices and family offices. So where you don't have a bank service or financial service, but you have wealthy people that have aggregated their fortunes.
Funds.
And when they do that, some of them also want to say, okay, that has to be invested in a sustainable manner.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clear that a lot of this we don't see in every day. We don't see that reported in the media. We don't see that article that you might see on IKEA setting a climate target, or on this or that new product coming to your supermarket that's green. That's much more upfront and everyday.
Mm-hmm.
But the workings of the financial sector is less so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so even though we might not see it in our everyday media, it's actually perhaps even more impactful than that one company setting a climate target.
Yeah, but the example of, let's say you were a small producer of, let's say, furniture, you try to put a product on the market, say this furniture is all FSC certified, it meets the Green Claims Directive and so on and so forth, and the one opting it or the retailer that you would sell it off to, it says, I'm not sure I can sell that, and people don't want to pay the uptick on the price. But if you as a producer the day after go to your bank to take a long-term commercial loan. And the bank says, yeah, that's all good, but we're a responsible bank, we want to be able to claim that. So you have to use FSC certified input. Mm-hmm. Then that's another conversation. If it comes mm-hmm. from your banking connection, or then they build it into the business model that you will discuss with your bank.
And are we seeing that process as well?
We're seeing that process as well. Certainly not as widespread and as quickly as we would want it to be. But from the exposure I have to the financial sector, I see that coming.
Okay. Oh, so interesting. The other follow-up question I have is, we've been talking many times by now on this podcast about the European Deforestation Regulation, or the EUDR. And I can't help but wonder whether this piece of legislation, because we've also talked about CSRD and green claims, et cetera, which really primarily focuses on the companies inside the EU. Is this the EU taxonomy? It even has EU in its name. Is this yet another piece of EU legislation that is mainly relevant to stakeholders who are inside the European Union, or do you see a potential global effect of this?
A global effect for sure, but not changing the world. Because again, it's been done, this opt-in mechanism I said before, comes with this smart wording that whenever you place a financial product on the EU market and you want to appraise that, then you have to follow all of this. So that means it's not only European financial institution. It means that it's somewhere in the internal strategic machinery of JP Morgan, also Asian banks, whoever is offering a financial product within EU on the internal market have to consider this. So it reaches way beyond. And it also means that if you place a financial product on the EU market that is backed by an investment done outside of the EU, then that investment needs to align. So in that sense, it has implications for financial sector's activities way beyond the EU, both in terms of the institutions, but also in terms of their investments. So in that sense, yes. And we're also seeing similar taxonomies and disclosure regimes having been put in place in New Zealand already a couple of years ago, in Australia last year. Something is underway, as far as I believe, in Korea and Japan, if it's not already there. So it's slowly in some jurisdictions building up.
Mm-hmm. And are these different ones that are popping up? I know that this is maybe not something that you know, but are they aligned? Because otherwise I could see that there would be some confusion if the EU defines this is sustainability or this is sustainable management of forests, let's say that. And then you have New Zealand or Australia or Korea having a slightly different legislation that is being put in place. Are these different taxonomies aliged?
I think we have to be honest on that one. And exactly as you said, they are slightly different. They cover the same themes, so to speak. They have a lot of criteria in common, but they also have critical elements where they differ. I haven't done a full and detailed analysis, but there are some thresholds, there are some definitions, there are some specific management practices that are allowed in one, not in another. So it's mm-hmm. not completely aligned. And that is adding complexity for these institutions.
Yeah, especially because I guess if you're then a pension fund inside Europe, what happens if you then invest, for example, in forestry in New Zealand? Would you then have to adhere to both?
If you're not marketing a financial product in New Zealand, then it's the EU mm-hmm. one that applies. If you market your financial product in both jurisdictions, then you have to cover both. But at the end of the day, and that's perhaps also where we want to take this conversation, then sustainable forest management around the world has a lot in common. Obviously, there are differences, but that's also where certification schemes like FSC comes in. And if you can back and prove that at the economic activity level, so at the level of the forest that you own, that you comply with one or align with one, then my best guess is you're not very far away from also aligning with the other. Then you may need to change wording here or there in your two disclosure reports, but what happens on the ground is not materially different.
Okay. Good. Well, let's pivot. I now think I may understand some more about the taxonomy as such. Let's pivot towards that sustainable forestry and the role of FSC in adhering to such legislation or supporting adherence to such regulations and legislation. So, Andre, let me bring you in. You've been waiting so very patiently. Asker has been explaining about the taxonomy as such. How do you see it when you've been listening to him, listening to the conversation and just your background knowledge? How do you see that being coupled with biodiversity and ecosystem services or verified impact, as it's called in FSC?
I think when it comes like what is the role of FSC and how the biodiversity and ecosystem services can play in, I think it's probably good to mention that there is nothing like an official endorsement of voluntary certification schemes so far. And so it's a bit like uncertain what it would be the official role of FSC here and how it could like play in. We can easily say that even if we don't have that formal recognition, schemes like FSC can play a super important role in showing that the organizations are fulfilling the environmental and social performance goals. It can be both-sided, right? Like the organizations who are actually sourcing FSC material, then they are obviously better positioned in meeting any like legal like requirements on the ESG. And there are, I would say, they should automatically meet do not significant harm criteria, which Asger mentioned, right? And also, maybe I bring in the verified impact or the FSC ecosystem service procedure, where I think FSC goes beyond the traditional way of doing certification, where it's typically the compliance-based certification. While here we are actually going more to the outcome-oriented type of verification, where we are verifying a particular data coming out from the forest, which is being certified. And that data can be about different ecosystem services as biodiversity or carbon sequestration or water and soil protection. But we are also like entering into the more like the social spectre, so also dealing with recreational or cultural services linked with traditional and indigenous communities, right? And all these data shall be super helpful for the organizations who are actually doing the reporting, right? So both in the CSRD and the SFDR, these data might be very helpful for the organizations when they want to do their public reporting or all the reporting using the EU taxonomy. So in that sense, that's where I think FSC actually do the additional step.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it sounds like if you add a verified impact certification to your just regular FSC forest management certification, you might get additional data points, which can be very valuable if you have to report on CSRD or if you want to adhere to the taxonomy. I know that the verified impact procedure right now is under revision. Are we doing anything to adjust to the definition that is in the taxonomies?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, first, we are actually doing a number of benchmark exercises. So we are looking at different like legal but also voluntary frameworks, and we are looking at what they require, how actually our impacts are aligned with the requirements of the frameworks, so that we are kind of understand the overlap, and we also understand what can actually be communicated, how the claims can be used by the companies who are using them or supporting the certificate holders who are actually generating these claims. So we are looking outside this, and we obviously try to make the procedure as compliant with these frameworks as possible. It's also quite interesting to hear when we talk with different players in that space. We hear that there are no clear rules to follow, right? So there are like no official pathways how the claims can chip in into the reporting and so on. It's pretty much like up to the organizations how they transform the claims into the reporting and so on. But like our role is really to make sure that we capture the whole area within our procedure and the impact being generated. I would also probably mention that the FSC as such is also transforming the principles and criteria. And so Right now, the only kind of outcome-oriented procedure is actually the custom service procedure. But I think like FSC is aware that the direction is more in like getting more data and being able to communicate about the particular impact certificate holders are having. So we are also already now like thinking about like how to make the principles and criteria of the forest management standard more outcome-oriented. So on the top of the performance base, how we can actually make that also like outcome-oriented so that the certificate holders and the supply chain can communicate about the data being generated from the responsible forest management.
It's super interesting. I'm just going to translate to listeners who might not be as well versed in forest management standards and FSC, because we might have a few of them out there in the audience. So the principle and criteria is the set of underlying rules that sits behind all FSC national standards. And when we talk about making them more outcome orientated, it means taking them from being sort of a check mark, are you doing X, Y, Z, to being what is the data point that proves that you've done that so that you can take that data point and utilize it, for example, in impact measurement. Did I get that right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I'd like to ask a bit more about this process that you're doing. You said you're doing a mapping of the procedure, the verified impact procedure, what was previously called the ecosystem services procedure, and mapping it up against the different taxonomies, the different regulations that you see coming up. When do you expect to have that process finalized?
Well, we would like to have the general overview by the end of the year so that we kind of understand where we overlap with different frameworks. But I would also assume that this will be pretty much like ongoing process where we will need to come up with the ever-changing requirements, which we see. It's something what we would like to produce as part of the guidance so that we have done that exercise, for example, for the global biodiversity targets. So we kind of know like which impact it's playing with each of the target, and we same exercise we are doing with different frameworks, not only the CSRD in Europe, but also like different non-financial reporting frameworks globally. We would hope that this will be part of the guidance to the procedure so that the organizations who are actually using the procedure or doing the sponsorship for the forest management, they are aware about which impact can be used for what scheme and how.
Okay, I'm just out of curiosity, those other global standards that you're talking about, would that be something like science-based targets for nature or net zero commitments? Or
exactly, that mm-hmm. would be GRI or SBTN or TNFD, so all these like global standards. We hope they will not increase in number all the time. Rather than, like the trend is actually decreasing, which is good.
It probably will. Okay, really interesting. And it sounds like you will be building it into supporting guidance on how can you actually use verified impact certification to live up to these different either voluntary or regulatory frameworks.
Yep.
Super interesting. You also said as part of your reply that you're seeing companies work really differently with this and that it's really up to the individual company how they want to use the claims that are made in a verified impact certification. I'd like to ask you, Asker, because you're working with a lot of different companies, how are you seeing companies work with the taxonomy and with the regulation? Do you see them work in sort of a similar framework, or is it really up to the individual company of how are we going to implement this?
The starting point is that we're in the first rollout of all of this, and we haven't completed a compliance cycle, so we haven't had anyone fail or had confirmation that they did as intended. So there's a huge sort of system that will be built over the coming years where national competent authorities may do some of the checks. But I also just wanted to come back to the point in the delegated regulation on the taxonomy for forest activities. It does say as a do no significant harm criteria for adaptation, but also a substantial contribution criteria for climate change mitigation. So if you want to prove how good you've done on climate, then your activity, the compliance must be verified by a auditor within 2 years and again after 10 years. And that it mentions specifically that this EU taxonomy audit can be performed together with a forest certification. So anyone leaning into this wants to make a statement on climate change, and I think that's still the main driver of a lot of sustainability promotion of companies and investors, they would need an auditor out there. In our sector, they would rely on an FSC or PEFC certification to bag it. So the basis is there. But back to the question that you asked, in reality, a lot of forest managers, if we assume that we're, let's say, within the group of forest managers that are already considering sustainability, so they are certified or considering to be certified, they would probably also meet from some of their clients, the buyers, a need to report on various sustainability elements and criteria under this or that scheme. They may also want to develop carbon credits on some or all of that land. They may also be hoping to look into biodiversity credits whenever that takes off, if it ever does. They also are considering EU deforestation regulation and what they need to report there. And maybe if they're in a good setting, in a good jurisdiction, they also have national reporting requirements. So I think exactly what Andrei says there, and which is what I meet in my everyday work, is you never work with one of these schemes in isolation. And you never work with two of them and trying to figure out how you overlay them. You work with a lot of them at the same time. And maybe some of them apply on a part of your forest management unit. Maybe you have a conservation easement on another part on top of the whole thing. Maybe some of your area is outside of certification because you retire it for whatever purpose. That's the complexity they're all dealing with. And the EU taxonomy, as I see it, in the first couple of years here, it will be seen as adding more complexity. But I think in 5-10 years down the line, we've seen sort of a consolidation, where at least what I do at International Woodland Company is to say, okay, the taxonomy has the potential to become the mother of all other standards if you're a European actor, because it covers all of the themes and criteria we want to have covered, because it came out of this consensus process in Brussels over a long time. It may not have gotten everything right. It may not have gotten all criteria workable in practice. Some of them should be far more ambitious in my view. Some of them should be more catering for the specific situation. But by and large, we now have something set out in legislation applying to everyone putting a product on the EU market that goes across all sorts of legislation that can be the benchmark. And if you meet EU taxonomy, my best guess is you can report. That can substantiate, if you have it certified with FSC, that can substantiate that you're doing good towards global reporting initiatives, SBTN, SFDR, CSRD, as basis for a quality and part of a carbon crediting scheme. So maybe start there. Mm-hmm. Have your EU taxonomy aligned and certified, then you're in a good position for all of the other schemes.
You said a while back that for now it's voluntary. Has it been decided that it will be mandatory at some point?
As with many other pieces of legislation, then the first round of technical screen criteria for the EU taxonomy and all of that went fairly quickly. That was the activities mm-hmm. that we could all more or less agree on. It was a period, some of it stretched into Corona. Maybe that eased how willing and able people were to make compromises on virtual negotiations and all of that. But we got that pretty well carved out. But for example, for agriculture, hugely controversial in many parts of the world, you don't have technical screening criteria. You don't have an EU taxonomy that you can apply. And for a number of other activities, and there's a lot of conversation ongoing. So now we got into the nitty-gritty. Now we got into the phase where we got the first ones done, a lot of actors on both sides, industry, finance, NGOs, governments figured out, oh, okay, this can have more implications if we don't get it right. So now that process more or less got stalled. We don't see a lot of progress on the remaining criteria. So that initial ambition to make the taxonomy underpin a lot of legislation, I think is a bit up for grabs right now. We don't know when it will happen, because you can only do that in a lot of regulation when you have a fair coverage of economic activities, and you don't have that. We are blessed, some would say, not call it blessed, that we got those criteria fairly clearly set out for forest in the first go. There's a couple of other economic sectors that got the same. That's good. We can work on it. Let's just be happy that we got that and work with it and be a front runner sector because applying it globally and mandatory, it will change how we intend to do that, and it might take 5-10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be that it will be demand-driven. That's another thing.
What does companies then do right now? Do they know about it? Do they use it? Is it something that they're just looking at and thinking, oh, that's too complex, let's just wait it out and see?
Probably a fair assumption for a good number of companies. If you're under, let's say, sort of economic activity, so a company, corporation, not a financial institution, so you're under the CSRD and you're looking into making claims in your product, so you're also looking into the Green Claims Directive, then this will look very complicated. It's on your radar, but it's probably not something you think is worthwhile to do, really commit to in the next couple of years, unless your bank or investor force you to do so. That might happen in a few cases. But on the financial sector side, my general impression is that the big European financial institutions have it very much on the radar. There is sort of a sentiment that we should do that. But there's also a very keen eye on what's the risk of failing, again, because we haven't been through a compliance cycle. So we don't know what will be the applied benchmark for a number of these criteria. So that's inarguably going to hold back a number of financial institutions and thereby also the companies that they might have leverage over through lending or credit lines or investing or whatever. So,
and who is it that does that whole compliance cycle? Like, what you've mentioned it a couple of times now. When will we be through such a cycle, and who is it?
That's the $1 trillion question.
Because so nobody's responsible.
Well, someone is responsible. In the legislation, it's quite often mentioned, and I have it right here, that you have the relevant competent authority.
But that could be many authorities.
That could be many.
Tell me.
And just to note that this legislation was developed, the council formations in Brussels that relate to the financial sector. So all of this, when consulted back in the government, was run through ministries of finance, ministry of economy, and probably, hopefully, coordinated with other entities. But what I would guess is that in any country where the government in place or the main ministries are thinking, okay, we need to move on this, then they probably set up a working group to figure out how do we do that, who's relevant, the relevant authority for what. And after that comes then process of setting out, designating entities, setting up a control regime, hiring people that can do that or outsourcing it or who knows. And mm-hmm. I think that's really Achilles heel of this whole system. That is that if that's not in place, then you cannot complete a compliance cycle. And what do you then do if you have aligned with EU taxonomy, if you can't get those checks from the government? In a few instances, there is in the EU taxonomy on the forest side, you can then do it on your own with an auditor or certification body, but in some cases you cannot for some of the criteria. That's really the good question and the one that we talk about in my sector. How's that going to play out? When will we get guidance? When will it happen? Will we at all be operational? And that's a pretty annoying implementation risk to work with.
Yeah, I could imagine. It sounds like the legislation as such also does not really define it. Like there's no definition of how many different companies, what's the percentage of audits that we have to create, or what's the risk profile of the audits that we have to create to complete that compliance cycle? Because I'm assuming that not all companies who would adhere to this legislation would have such an audit by competent authorities.
That's true. Here we're probably also, let's say, a bit sector biased, the three of us working in certification and audits. To my best knowledge, I haven't seen anything very prescriptive of that in any of this legislation. Maybe there is an interpretation paper or guidance paper somewhere that puts some words to that. It seems that it's ultimately the responsibility of the relevant competent authority in the relevant EU member state in which this financial product is placed or the product itself is placed to figure out how they want to do that.
Oh, that's interesting, because then I guess that puts us on the same cycle as we saw with the previous timber regulation, so the EUTR, where it was also up to individual member countries to define what is relevant, which panned out to being very different replies to how much do we need to audit and actually monitor the implementation of this legislation, where the EUDR, so the new legislation under implementation, is much, much more prescriptive and really dictating so that we get a fair level across all of Europe.
Absolutely. That's the elephant in the room.
Interesting. So many companies are still trying to grapple how to work with this, but how would this look from a forest manager's point of view? What would their incentive be to start working with this?
If we look at the forest manager from a behavioral point of view, as the operator, as the change agent here, then imagine that they're currently in a situation where some of their off-takers are asking them to step up on sustainability. And so that's good, but not all of them. And when they go to the bank to get their loan or to get their credit line, they're just told, focus on numbers, earn money. That's what we want to see to increase your credit. So they have to internalize that, let's say, conflict between just maximizing profits and being able to act sustainably and perhaps change practices. But if the financial sector, when they meet that, would say, you need to reduce climate risks, you need to build resilience, you need to expand on biodiversity because it's important for us, then the change agent gets the backing to take action as required. I think we can build up all the incentives we want in the supply chain, but if you go to the bank and the bank says no, then what change is going to happen? We know that from ourselves as change agents in our lives. It might be a brilliant idea, everybody agrees to renovate the house, but if the bank says no, then you don't do it. And that applies to forest managers as well. So that, let's say, behavioral point of getting the financial sector behind change, I think has implications far beyond any one scale.
What you're describing could be a game changer and really push for positive change and using finance as a mechanism. But it could also become another paper exercise, especially because it sounds like there's not really a definition of how are we implementing this in practice, who's going to monitor it, etc. What can we do to avoid that?
The world always needs protagonists or front runners that go ahead and show it can be done. Obviously, in that process, you need to manage your risk, but still getting together and having an FSC-certified property, EU taxonomy aligned, getting an audit that is a combined audit of FSC and DNSH and substantial contribution, following the SFDR reporting disclosure templates, which has been set in law, and those are being controlled. There's already in France, we have seen government-sanctioned audits of the SFDR-level disclosures, which is much more high-level. So it's not all bleak and intransparent. Then others will follow. That's what we're trying to do at International Woodland Company. Say, okay, we are well-positioned FSC member for a lot more than a decade, working towards full FSC certification of all assets, developing a strategy for how to implement the EU taxonomy, working with some of the global certification bodies and developing such an audit product. Perhaps that's what it takes, someone showing it can be done, because then that'll also have ripple effect, because then our clients will go back to our competitors and say, they can do it. I'm sure you can.
I can't help but, is the taxonomy as such, is it prescriptive enough that it actually does require change?
That's a very good question.
Yeah, because if we run the risk of just discontent saying everything we already do, that's really good enough, yay, it's sustainable, and then we're not really seeing any progress. It's not pushing progress. It's just more of the same.
There is as many definitions of change and progress as you can have parties to this discussion. What does the EU taxonomy do? It rules out a number of practices through do no significant harm that you cannot do. Is that change? Yes, it's lowering the bottom threshold for what is allowed to do out there. Will that have significant effect in some forests, in some jurisdictions? Yes, in others? No, we're already there. I would say in the case of Denmark or other European countries, do no significant harm will do very little change. But in other places, it might do. Then in terms of, let's say, changing the mindset of investors and companies around, yes, it is pushing, okay, you need to think about these risks. You need to think about there is an upside. That's going to have an effect. But in terms of transforming all the world's commercial forests into more resilient, better habitat quality, more ecosystem services provisioning, I doubt it. On that side, the criteria on climate change mitigation could have been much more strict, in my view. It takes a bit of more effort on the side of most companies, and forest managers, but not a lot. Maybe next time when it's reviewed in 15 years, we can get stricter on that.
And when it perhaps becomes more mandatory. Last question is just me trying still to understand all of this, because we're now tying how we're managing our assets, how we are managing forests, how we're managing ecosystems to a financial value. If we look at CSRD, for example, all of a sudden we're moving all of our work in a company with sustainability into something that also really ties into the reporting and accountants and the finance department of the companies. And one of my worries is that when we're moving all of this and all of the documentation over there, is that the finance department are really, really good at looking at numbers, because that's what they've been trained to do. But I don't think that many of them have had much training in trying to evaluate the effect of ecosystem services protection, or evaluating one initiative over another and how much impact it has, et cetera. How are they supposed to do that? Do we have a system for that?
I think it takes brains and mindset, and then second order tools. It's my best impression that that we've seen a small surge of earth science backgrounds, biologists, ecologists, geologists, geographers, into the financial sector over the last 3, 4, 5 years to build the capacity and brain power to do that exact assessment. Because yes, it's numbers, but it's other numbers on ecosystems that behave differently than an economic system necessarily. That's one indicator that we're seeing that happening right now. And there's also a confusing proliferation of startups and companies that offer a tool that can analyze all of that and give you two indicators. And also some companies that provide more substantial analytical support. So that's a whole new sector. Nature tech. That's a whole new sector that FSC is also following and involved it with World Forest ID and so on and so forth. And that's the other half of it. There's always someone out there that will support you in return for a payment.
Mm-hmm. Andre, let me bring you in. What do you see FSC's role in all of this and in supporting this transition towards new numbers?
I think there is still like yet another layer. Like if we zoom in and we look either at the SFDR, the financial disclosure, then there is obviously a role for FSC to help the companies who are disclosing about this to communicate more about the sustainability whenever the forest is certified, then the risks. So it can work as a kind of a risk mitigation measure. And whenever forest would have the verified impact as well, then they would be obviously able to communicate the direct positive impact or the change which is driven by the particular investment. Therefore, I think like there is all this room for FSC to work on this field and try to connect these two worlds of the financial and then the forest managers. The beauty of FSC is that we already have the chain of custody. So we have both sides, right? We are working with the forest managers, but we are also working with the whole chain of custody. And now when we are introducing blockchains and the technology side, I think that's like super important moment where we can really make the difference in helping the organizations to track back not only the volumes of material, but also all the data connected with the forest. And on the other side, while developing the verified impacts, we are also obviously looking of how we can help the certificate holders to collect certain data, how FSC can actually play this role in getting this data for the certificate holders or working together with the certificate holders in getting this data. And I think this is also very important role FSC will need to play in the years to come to become this intermediate between all the players in the sector. If FSC wants to stay relevant in the world which we are now seeing, we will need to take this role and be more active. But as you mentioned, like after all, it will need to be somehow translated into the numbers, right? Like it's more like an accounting type of word. Again, like where the customer service procedure will need to come in and deliver the data which the companies finally can use in their reporting, because it's might not be really possible to say, hey, well, we saw FSC certified material, therefore there are no risks, but there is also like nothing to report in the final accounting system. And yeah, again, like this is a huge possibility for the verified impact or for the customer service procedure to help these companies to source these data, to be able to report on them, obviously to cover, well, both like the biodiversity and the climate side of it. And finally, also like Asger mentioned, the carbon removal certification framework, which is another field which I believe in the future should be relevant for FSC, where FSC could help the certificate holders to kind of quantify the additional carbon removed, and which then again could be linked with the market.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you're almost saying that FSC could be one of the tools that ask us saying is actually needed in the market, that we could actually play that role of being a systematized, a multi-stakeholder aligned and agreed tool that could support the market.
We are very well positioned to play this role, considering the fact that we are already have a lot of, you know, certified hectares in different biomes. We are working closely with the forest managers, but also the whole supply chain, and the fact that we are like now starting with all the projects with the technology and the advanced system. I think we are well positioned in becoming the help.
Mm-hmm. I have one final question for you both. I'm going to ask you to be honest. Do you think that this legislation will have the effect that it's intended to have? And what will it take for it to do so?
That was two questions in one. Will it have some effect? Yes, it will. Will it have the intended effect?
Oh, sorry.
Well, that depends a lot on how all of this compliance cycle and implementation plays out. Let's see. And also the negotiation on the remaining activities. If we hone in on the forest sector alone, then I believe it will. It is a landmark piece of legislation. And if we look at how it is used to support a number of critical pieces of the legislation, CSRD, green claims, carbon wool certification, SFDR, and other, then it has a huge reach. So in terms of being implemented and used, yes. Whether that then drives the change we need to see, that's more open. But it will at least weed out a lot of practices we don't want to see.
Yeah, I think like we are at the beginning of a very long journey. And yeah, it's a bit difficult to foresee where this will end up. I do see how easy for the EU legislation is to have something very nice on paper, but then not really being translated into reality, while looking at EUTR, for example, or looking at RED II, then like we could clearly see that where we had like quite a nice piece of legislation with a lot of potential in like doing changes on the ground, and then the whole legislation kind of end up vast majority, if not all, the risk assessment being low risk, therefore like claiming like everything is sustainable. And the only impact of that legislation was pretty much of like additional cost and bureaucracy for the players in the biomass sector, because they still had to undergo the audits, pay the fees, and so on. But I do remain optimistic. I think we have learned from these, well, experiences and like, yeah, that we needed to also like fail to find out better way. And for example, looking at EUTR, I think it's much more improved than EUTR. And I do want to believe that in terms of the impact on the ground, this is actually the improvement we could see. And therefore, that's what I'm saying. Like, we are probably on the beginning of a long journey. We won't see the change now on, but as Asgard said, maybe with the next review, we will take the step where we can get to getting a real impact seen on the ground. So I'm really optimistic. I just don't think it will be as fast as we would hope. So,
Yeah, because 5-10 years for the next review is quite a long time. And do we have that time?
Yeah, but we also need to learn the things, right? Like when you speak with the organizations who need to use the reporting framework, then they are completely lost. They are still like learning it. And even speak with the organizations who are actually doing the audits, they're also, they don't even know like what to look at and so on. So it's a process which we will need to somehow learn. And I think by the time we get to a new revision, we will already have a good system and we will know what to do around it.
Mm-hmm. Let's hope in the meantime that companies like International Woodland sets the bar high so that we can get that revision up at a good level. Thank you, both of you, for your time and for explaining the taxonomy to me and all of the connected legislations and how it all connects to the world of FSC.
Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you, Laura.
That's it. I hope you now know much more about the EU taxonomy than you did before pressing play on this episode. I know I do. I also am much more aware of the kind of work it will take to make this legislation something that can change the world, because let's face it, in the end, money and rules will triumph all good intentions. Let us hope that both Asuka and Andre have their dreams come true, that we manage to unlock the potential of this legislation to drive real change. Just with the sheer size of the markets we're talking about, it could be a real game changer for pushing certification into new forest areas. As an example, more than 2 million hectares of forest in high and middle income countries could be certified to FSC if the European pension funds required it, because they invest in them. If we add other regions and other market drivers to that, the number of hectares would increase. So in other words, there's no doubt that we, with the taxonomy and the connected legislations, could see yet another legislative driver with the potential for true impact on combating climate change and biodiversity loss. Let's hope with Andre that we've learned from the RET and the EUTR processes and found a form where our implementation actually translates into real change on the ground, and that it does so fast. This concludes this episode. Thank you for listening, and remember to subscribe if you want to get notified of new episodes where we dive into other innovations within FSC and the world of certification and sustainable forest management. You can also always get a hold of me on podcast@fsc.org with questions or suggestions for topics I should pick up. I am Laura Worm, and this was Forest for the Future.